Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to this week's segment of Live Without Limits. Today our guest speaker is Nancy Duncan with the Disability Resource Group, and I would like to give you a little bit of background about the Disability Resource Group. In the early 90s, the group concerned citizens and disability community began meeting monthly in Atlanta to talk about problems and successes in terms of implementation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The group named itself the ADA Exchange, the Southeast Disability and Technical Assistance Center at Georgia Tech provided some of the leadership and logical support for the early group. In 1994, the ADA Exchange became ADA Technical Assistance Center for Georgia using a grant from Southeast DivTech. In 1995, the exchange was incorporated into the state of Georgia. The exchange moved from an ADA educational program to an organization working to bring about the full inclusion of all Georgians with disabilities in all aspects of the community. The board chose to expand the original purpose of the exchange to include training and consulting activities that would not only open doors to people with disabilities, but that would also build networks between the disability community and other service systems. We are the only statewide organization in Georgia that is qualified to respond to inquiries about disability. The accomplishments are, over the last 10 years, the organization has grown to include paid membership of 160 members with a quarterly newsletter mailing list of over 600. The exchange conducts informational seminars and workshops on disability-related topics approximately one per week across the state. The exchange works closely with several dozen disability organizations and many state and county agencies. Consultation is provided to churches, private service providers, architectural firms, universities, parent support groups, law firms, rehabilitation counselors, disability advocacy groups, etc. In 1999, the exchange expanded its services to include statewide transportation, projects funded by the Statewide Independent Living Council, and Campaign 2000 projects funded by the Georgia Council on Developmental Disabilities. The exchange received and successfully implemented a one-year grant from the Ms. Foundation with a goal of building working relationships between the domestic violence service system and the disability advocacy system. The ultimate objective of the project was to begin to reduce the high rate of violence against women with disabilities. The exchange is involved in the statewide task force on health initiatives for underserved women. As a result of our work on this task force, the exchange received a substantial grant in 2004 and 2005 from the American Cancer Society. This grant, both training for health department staff on disability and customer service, and education outreach on the importance of cancer screening for women with disabilities. The exchange received two grants to provide training and consultation to the Georgia Department of Labor Career Centers and Employer Committee to assist them in fulfilling their obligations under the Workforce Investment Act. As part of our Know Your Rights project, we presented information and motivational workshops to high school students with disabilities at 11 high schools in Georgia in 2002 and 2003. The project culminated in the publishing of Know Your Rights Handbook written for high school students with disabilities. Building One Community, a project funded by the Georgia Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and managed by the exchange, worked in 8 high schools to significantly increase inclusion on students with developmental disabilities into the extracurricular and social activities of their community. Entiendo Auto is an ongoing project to inform Hispanic people with disabilities and their families about self-determination and options for independent living. We now translate most of our material into Spanish, and these materials are also posted on our website. In 2004, the exchange was an integral part of the Georgia Secretary of State initiative to increase a participation of voters with disabilities in the election process. We provided training on disability inclusion to poll officials in every county in Georgia. Additionally, we assisted with a voter education project for people with disabilities and the production of training video for poll workers. In 2005, we received a grant from the Atlanta Community Foundation to expand on our Hispanic project, reaching out to recent immigrants and refugees with disabilities from developing countries. We realized that this population and the agencies who support them were unaware of the many services and opportunities to Georgians with disabilities. As a part of our outreach, we have translated our materials into 7 diverse languages and are conducting disability awareness training for refugee support agencies. This year, we became a United Way partner, receiving $12,000 to expand our Hispanic outreach program. We are beginning a disability and disaster planning project with 13 coastal counties using a grant from the Department of Human Resources. On July 1st, the Georgia ADA Exchange changed its name to Disability Resource Group in order to better reflect the wide variety of services that we provide and the reality that we often serve people outside our state. We are continuing in the solid tradition of the exchange. Today, the Disability Resource Group has 13 affiliates across Georgia. Each month, on an average, we distribute over 500 pieces of material and respond to over 150 telephone calls from people seeking technical assistance and advice. These calls range from questions about accessibility guidelines, guidance in accommodating employees with disabilities, and phasing of agency policy to where to begin living one's life as a person with a new disability, from workshops for daycare providers in rural coastal Georgia to participation on the design team for a high-end shopping mall in Metro Atlanta. The Disability Resource Group seeks to raise disability awareness so that people with disabilities are included elsewhere. The exchange continues to build new networks with organizations throughout Georgia, remaining committed to bringing about full inclusion of all people with disabilities into all aspects of life in Georgia. Come on, good morning. Oh, shit. Come on. So, I gotta get back to where I am, which is Blog Talk Radio, and go from there. I got much up. Hello, hello, hello. Switchboard, come back, switchboard. Come back, switchboard, switchboard, switchboard. Okay, let's see. On air. Hello.
Hello?
Yeah, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, yeah. Let me get back to the question so I can go with you from there. But can you give me, what I want you to do is go on and give us a little bit of background about how you got into working, you know, what's your background in disability issues?
I'm Nancy Duncan. I am the director of Disability Resource Group, and I am also a person with a disability. I am totally blind. I started losing my sight when I was a teenager, and I really didn't have anything to do. I didn't want to have anything to do with disability for a number of probably 10 years. After I started losing my sight, I just wanted to pretend like it wasn't happening and it wasn't about me. And I probably was 10 years before I could even say I am blind. But kind of the bridge for me, I got a guide dog. And I just would not carry a cane. I didn't like the way that looked. And but a dog, lots of folks walk dogs, so that was a fairly normal thing to do, I felt like. And I could talk about my dog and what my dog could do. And that was kind of the way that I was able to move into advocacy. The first job I really had was working with my and helping other people with advice and teaching them and counseling them. And I decided I wanted to go to graduate school and get more training and counseling because I realized that that was a key piece, feeling good about yourself, feeling positive about yourself. That would make the difference in, as to whether or not you really succeeded as a person with a disability. So after graduate school, I got into a whole other field. I went into the area of statewide prevention program, how to live healthy. Emotionally healthy lives so that alcohol would be an option or an escape mechanism. I really wasn't a real strong advocate, though, for people with disabilities outside my personal area until at age 5 we adopted a son, Daniel, who was also blind, and he was also I had to become an advocate during the pandemic. And we got him 3.5, and he was awful and awful. Daniel has taught me so much. And I didn't know the whole area of developmental disabilities. Got involved right away in advocacy. And then in 94, the disability, Georgia ADA Exchange, it was then, a group of people who got together once a month and talked about how we could bring about a plot for the ADA in Georgia. They hired me to be the first director. And I've gotten a lot of information in the South Coast Disability Institute. I've gone to California twice to get training from the Disability Rights Administration. And I've gotten training from the Justice Department. Lots of other workshops and stuff that I did. So I've just learned a lot as I've gone. constantly looking for new information and looking for places where I can understand better and do more things. So I just do a lot of learning and marketing and stuff to work with tribes and immigrants and refugees and disabilities. And it's very hard to find because
If someone wants to get involved in advocacy, what is their best route to take?
Well, I would say that I would call first the 800 number for the technical assistance centers, which is 800-949-4232. 800-949-4232. That they have their 10 regional offices all over the United States, Alaska, Hawaii included. And they can tell you about local organizations in your area and figure out if you want to be involved in an advocacy group just for your particular disability interest or the wider picture. There's a support group for a disability organization almost every year. There may not be one in your town, and if there's not, you can start one. Because one out of five Americans has a disability, that number is growing every day. Lots of folks are baby boomers who are getting old. We're getting older and joining our 60s, the majority of us, and most in their 60s get disabilities. And there are children who are surviving very small birth weights, very serious illnesses, who have disabilities that 10 years ago would have died and not been alive. So there's a growing population. Plenty of people, wherever you are, who have disabilities, you can join and advocate for participation, access, growing more quality in our
neighborhood. Okay. And what would a good educational background for them to have if they're interested in going into it as a profession?
Well, it kind of depends on what area you want to go into. I mean, one of the best advocates I know doesn't even have a PhD. But she's very passionate and she's very committed and she's willing to work hard to speak to people and talk to her congressmen and her representatives. And my son, now that I mentioned earlier, is 25 and he writes letters regularly to presidents and senators. He had a couple of letters published in USA Today. That he's written the president. And he's a very good advocate, and he has a special ed diploma and probably would have the equivalent of a fifth grade education. So it's not a matter of how much education you have or how much experience you have. If you have the experience of being a person with a disability, you could be a good advocate.
Okay, and who determines what is reasonable in terms of accommodation for people with disabilities?
Well, there's two places where reasonable is used for Americans with disabilities. One place that most people think of is employment, and that reasonable accommodation is a key term in the employment regulations of the ADA. And reasonable means it's not too expensive, so that it really hurts the business. It doesn't change the way basic way business is done. It's very and the employer really makes the decision. Now, if I, the employee, disagree, if I ask the employer for a larger monitor so that I can read what the computer says that and the employer says, I can't do it, that's too expensive, that's unreasonable. So I know the larger model is about $150. And if I'm working for a great big company, I know that's ridiculous to say that's unreasonable. So if I really disagree, I can of course go to the department and present my case, and I can call an advocate or a good cat, and I'll be able to get a decision. And say, what can I do? I can pull down off the internet material about that. Or I can file a complaint with the EEOC. Federal level or in my state, and say this is, he will not give me a large money. Before I get to that point, is I can contact the state or the rehabilitation office. And if I can make it clear that I'm going to lose my job or I don't get a large free money, they might be willing to buy it for me. So there's a lot of ways to go, but ultimately, the court decides. If I can't agree with my employer and we're arguing about it, I feel like it's reasonable, then I can get an attorney after I file the complaint. I can get an attorney and go into federal court, and the judge will decide what is reasonable and what is not. But it's kind of reasonable based on a common sense of definition. If I ask them to fly to work every day on their debt, most people will probably think that's unreasonable. And so I don't believe it, but nobody else in the country can do what I can do. It's very difficult to say that's not not very clear one way or the other. That's when it's hard to determine. There's also reasonable modification of that topic is set phrases in Title II and Title III. And that means changes in the policy or the procedures of an agency or business that would make it easier for a person with a disability to use the goods or services that the business offers or the services that the government offers. So it's reasonable in a common sense way. I'm asking for an office to simply meet with me in a more accessible way. Change the entire way something is done so that I can participate, that might be unreasonable.
Okay, now we've talked about what are reasonable accommodations that companies need to be made. What are some, and we talked about what would be a good case, what are some things that would be a case that people bring up that may be a frivolous case you trying to apply ADA as their reason?
Well, I had an interesting case. A man called me from Florida, and he said, I feel like I'm being discriminated against. He said, my town, I've lived in this town for 10 years. He said, I'm in a wheelchair. I use a wheelchair, a lift van. And he said, we've never had to pay to park in handicapped parking. And now just this year, the city is starting to charge for handicapped parking. And I'm mad as heck. I want to file a complaint. So I said, well, do people who don't have disabilities have to pay to park? And he said, sure. So I said, well, then, the ADA doesn't give people with disabilities stuff that everybody else doesn't have. It's trying to level the playing field. so that everybody has equal access to business and government and employment. So if everybody else pays for handicapped parking, everybody else pays for parking, then people with accessibility stickers or handicapped stickers or whatever you want to call it, it's only right that you would pay too. Now, it would be illegal to charge people for the accessible parking and not charge the other people to park in regular spaces. But, you know, and that would be a little bit frivolous. Sometimes people say, you know, I have stress and I need to take off work. And everybody has stress, and what the employer must do and the individual with that claims to have a disability must do is, you know, you have to, if you ask for an accommodation on the job, the employer can ask you to bring a letter from the doctor stating what your disability is, what the doctor recommends in terms of your job. And so I have stress to the degree that I'm taking the medication. She said you just got to take about 2 weeks of rest or you're going to have heart attack. Then that becomes something that I can take to my employer and ask for that 2 weeks leave because of my doctor's recommendation. There's also a medical that requires employees if there's more than 10 employees and if you as an employee have worked more than 2 years. It requires employers to let you take off for health reasons, but without pay, up to 12 weeks a year for a family or a boy. And so that's another option. Have under stress. Quite a lot of folks call me and say, I'm under stress and I'm just very unhappy. I feel depressed and, you know, I want my employer to give me more breaks and give me a longer lunch hour. That may be privilege unless the doctor says this is essentially
okay, that may clear it up for a lot of people because I know, what's the percentages of lawsuits that are pretty much frivolous that tend to be filed that have created or made changes to the ADA as it was originally written?
Well, I don't think there are a lot of frivolous lawsuits in terms of the ADA because there are very few lawyers that file cases about the ADA. There have been some law firms in some states, not in Georgia, but there's been quite a few law firms in some other states that have filed a lot of Title III cases where restaurants and stores and maybe banks, caterers are not accessible, and they, instead of, you know, trying to negotiate with them, they just file the lawsuit. Because after all, the ADA has been in existence since 1990. So that's 18 years that people should have been trying to become accessible. And some folks with disabilities are just sick of it and retire them, estimate it. And those should not be frivolous lawsuits. They might be filed too quickly. And maybe not, you know. I know some folks, one of the most famous restaurants in Savannah, some folks down there have worked and worked and worked trying to get that restaurant to make an attempt to be accessible. And
are you talking about the pirate sound? Okay, because I know a lot of grew up there. I know all the rest, pretty much all the rest.
Right.
Okay, what are some of the requirements that for paratransit services?
Well, I get a lot of calls about paratransit, and for those of you who are not, you know, authorities on the ADA, paratransit is the special, specialized or adapted transportation service that any city or county that operates a regular bus service that goes into town, out of town, up and down the street, making stops, that regular bus service, if you have a regular bus service, also under the ATA, have to have an adapted bus service. That's a door-to-door service for people who can't use the regular bus service because of a disability. And you have to go through a process to get approved to be a paratransit rider. Sometimes they're small lift vans, sometimes they're bigger vans, but they're always adapted vans that pick up at their door and take them to where they want to go. And there's a lot of problems here in Atlanta and some other cities about folks that call the day before, call up to the day before to get the same reservation. And they say, I'm sorry, we're too full. The law says if they're too full, very often, then they're not in compliance with the law. They've got to keep slots open. And no more than half of their ridership can be people who go every day, like to and from work or to and from school, something like that. And they've got to leave slots open for folks who are just going to the mall or going to the store or going to a bar or wherever they are. None of the city's business where you're going. They don't use the regular bus system to say you can only go to the doctor on this bus. So they can't restrict the parent members. And they have to be reasonable, more than a half an hour on the side of the animal picked up and drop off. So they can't pick you up 2 hours early and drive you all over the city.
I lived in Florida, and they don't really have a good public transportation system, so the only available source was the paratransit. And even this was a few 12-13 years ago, but even then you always had to give them 24-hour notice for pickup, and you always had to have at least a half an hour to an hour leeway. And in Atlanta we got the public transportation system and you pay half fare. And yet, when you use the paratransit system, because it's door-to-door, they charge you $3.50. So, and that's generally what they charge for
That brings up a pretty good point. The ADA says in that the ADA says you cannot charge more than twice of the regular bus route fare. And the Atlanta takes it to the limit and says, okay, we're charging double. Some cities don't charge any difference. They just get better subsidies for their paratransit. And it's the same whether you're riding a regular bus or whether you're riding paratransit. Of course, that half fare card, which a lot of cities have, so that it costs you half if you ride the regular bus, if you have a disability and have a card to have a disability. That is to encourage everybody that possibly can ride the regular bus, because it costs a lot more for a paratransit system than it does a bus system. And as many people should ride the regular bus as possible. But there are quite a few folks who, because of their disability, for example, a person who has multiple sclerosis, MS, that person might be able to use a regular bus on a day when weather is very nice. But when it's extremely cold or extremely hot, being out in the weather waiting on a bus could be fatal, the person with MS. So if the weather is bad, they need the paratransit. On the other hand, the person who is blind uses a regular bus to go on from work. But if that person needs to go to a doctor's appointment in an area they're not at all familiar with, where there's really heavy traffic and very difficult to figure out, then the blind person might use paratransit to go to that doctor. I think it's important for people with disabilities to fly to use the regular bus as much as possible. So it takes the pressure off of their transit. But, and it's a lot quicker and simpler to just get on the bus and go. But then, well, not to hesitate to use their transit if it's really necessary.
Okay. Some people think that ADA is just for people with wheelchairs. What are some of the requirements that help people with other disabilities?
Well, the ADA is not just a building code. A lot of people think that the ADA is just how wide doors should be and how many ramps you should have or how many parking places with accessible parking places. And it is that. In Title III of the ADA, there's a section that's called the ADA Accessibility Guidelines. And they have all the requirements, like how wide doors should be and all that. But they also have some things for people who are deaf, like a requirement that public places have a visual alarm, not just an audible alarm, but for a fire alarm, and that like in bathrooms, in public buildings, there be a visual alarm so that if people are, you know, not in the same place as everybody else, they know that there's a fire alarm. There's a requirement that hotel rooms have door knockers, alarm flashes, things like that that have hearing impairment. There are requirements in terms of flight for the elevator. You have to have a large print and braille characters on the panel. And they also have to ding once going up and ding twice when they're going down. And they have to have a little sound that you can have a little bit of going down that your voice has so the person can count. That has to be their requirements about seeing having a brand of large print of permanent and like doors and hotels, numbers by your hotel room. There are requirements about detectable warnings for a visually impaired person that feels or sees a warning or sees a danger or around a fountain. Those are some of the accessibility guidelines, rules for architects and builders. And of course, there's all kinds of things major obligations that employers, government, state, local, and businesses have. Not just provide this for people without disability, they have to provide it with disability. And then there's effective communication, and that if you provide this information to people without disability, you must make sure people with disabilities get this information too. So that may be put it in braille or put it in print or something that's spoken, write it down, or have a sign language interpreter, like that kind of thing. And then the third obligation is physical access. But not discrimination, the effective communication and physical access are all requirements. And that affects everything.
What would be a good description that the ADA gives for what a disability is and who qualifies under the law?
There's three parts of the definition in the ADA for who is a person with a disability. The first one is a person with a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. So that means that it can be either physical or mental, and it's got to keep you from doing something major. If you say, well, you know, I can't, maybe you were a brain surgeon and you developed arthritis, and you no longer, your hands are not steady enough to do the very delicate kind of work you have to do with brain surgery. You're not a person with a disability now, because you can still do most everything else in your life, even though you can't do the things that you train and work on your life. You can still do a lot of other jobs. You can still stretch yourself and feed yourself, often talk and sleep and all that. But if you are a person, we'll say, who was a construction worker and you fell or broke your back, and now you can only walk with a walker and you can't walk very far, then that's affected major parts of your life. And so you are a person with a disability. If you generally have a diagnosis from a doctor, long-term, long-term treatment, that would have been a way of confirming that you are a person with a disability. Then a second part of the definition is that you have a record of a disability. You can't be discriminated against just because of what you had been or what you had mental illness that caused you to be hospitalized, or because of what you were in alcohol treatment. You can't discriminate against people because of what happened to them related to disability in the past. You can fire somebody who's drinking on the job, but you cannot fire somebody because you found out they're a member of AA. Because that would be discriminating against them because of what they have to do. Then the third part of the definition is complicated to say, well, basically, you know, already has had a disability. I mean, somebody goes going to that, but it's very complicated. And I think it's just confusing, but if somebody has a burning desire to know more about that, you can talk to them in your local facility.
Okay, now, a lot of the soldiers coming back from the war, you know, had severe head injuries. How does the ADA cover them, and what can they expect under the ADA?
Well, we're seeing an increasing number of people with head injuries, both veterans and people who are in auto accidents in this country. Auto accidents kill thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans every year, and leave a whole lot of folks with other types of disabilities, for killing people here. But a head injury is if I fall down and blow my head and I have a big knot on my head and I just have a headache for a couple of weeks, that's my disability. But if the head injury causes me to not be able to do the major things in my life, like if I have trouble learning and remembering, or if I have trouble sleeping, if I am busy and can't walk, if I can't concentrate for more than 10 minutes, those kinds of things are major life activities. And so at that point, the brain is a disability under the ADA. And then I would be protected. I can't be discriminated against because I have that disability. I would have accommodations in the workplace and make a lot of decisions from the state and local government. And all the things that everybody else would be protected by the ADA.
Okay, how does the ADA help kids in school?
A lot of people ask the question about, you know, a lot of parents know about IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And that law is the one that sets up special education and says you have to serve all children in the most appropriate manner and so that they can have access to an education. But the ADA covers everybody with a disability, and it says you can't discriminate against them just because they have a disability. So if you are a school system and you have a playground, one of the awful things that I've heard is about schools, and the kids all go out and play on the playground, and the two children in wheelchairs sit and watch. I mean, that's horrible. That's really horrible. So if you're going to have a playground under the ADA, if you're going to have a playground for kids without disabilities, you've got to make sure that the kids with disabilities can play too. So that's how the ADA goes beyond, it goes beyond IDEA. It doesn't have to be in the child's IEP, but the school has to make sure that to the parents, the whole school, if the school puts on a play and invites the community, and someone who's deaf who doesn't have a job yet comes to the play, they can request a sign language from the school has to provide. School is part of the community, and they have to
Well, the IDEA is actually set up to address getting the education for the kids in the school and for parents to sit down with teachers and come up with a plan for the year for each student on their goals for the year. The ADA addresses all the other issues.
Yeah, it addresses all the issues. It's an umbrella over everything. It would help the teacher with a disability. It would help the parent with a disability. It would help the child with a disability. People say, well, you're not going to allow a person who is on crutches to be in the band. Well, that's illegal under the ADA. It doesn't matter whether it's an IEP or not. That band is open to all students who can play an instrument. And if you're on crutches and can't play an instrument, you can't be in the band. But if you're not on crutches, you can't play an instrument. But if you can play an instrument, and then you should be able to be in the band.
Okay, and what do you do if a restaurant or hotel doesn't comply with the law?
Again, I get a lot of questions about this, and I've actually done some training for hotels and restaurants who didn't comply with the law. A lot of times folks call the police. You know, if I have my guide dog and I go into a hotel and they say, we don't allow dogs here. A lot of folks call the police. Well, the police really can tell the owner, you have to let this guide dog in, but they can't arrest the owner. You don't arrest people for violating the ADA, just like you don't arrest people for violating the Civil Rights Act. What I have to do if I'm a person with a disability and I've been discriminated against by a hotel or a restaurant or a bank or whoever, then what I have to do is I can file a complaint with the Justice Department. That's the legal thing I can do. I can also hire an attorney and take the court. The best thing to do is to call an advocacy group, and say what you think of it. I give them the information. I try to always tell people to do this, so that if I run into that, I can give them a pamphlet with the Justice Department seal in front of it so they know it's real. And I try to negotiate always first. You know, that's the best thing. Usually when people are turned away from the restaurant, a lot of times it's owned by people from other countries that don't have laws like the ADA and don't know that, that the health laws don't apply to service animals, or don't know that the health laws, you know, and they don't know that people in wheelchairs have to be seated. They just don't know because they don't have it in their own laws. So generally, education works. Sometimes the one time when I was turned away from a restaurant because of my guide dog, other patrons were like, "Hey, wait, you can't do that. That's a guide dog. That has to be allowed in." So sometimes I have done that, and the manager said, "Oh, okay." I always try to have people negotiate with people before I actually try to call a lawyer or contact the Justice Department. Because most people don't mean to be mean. They don't know any better. Occasionally, there are people who just refuse to deal with social disability. That's the time, I guess, when then you do call a television studio, or you call them.
How can a company request training on the ADA if they need it to learn more about the law and how it applies to their service?
Well, again, people can call that their Disability and Business Technical Assistance Center, which is 800-949-4232. They can put you in touch with someone in your local area who could provide that training. Our organization provides training. A lot of other organizations across the country do. I know the Women's the Disability Resource Group, our website is disabilityresourcegroup.org. We can certainly help you find someone who can do training. There are good trainers and there are not good trainers, like there are in every area. But your disability business and technical assistance center will certainly have our good qualified trainers.
Okay, we've got 8 minutes. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss with the audience?
I don't think so. Do we have some questions?
Let's see what we can come up with. Okay. Can you give some examples of some cases that were good cases that were covered under ADA, and which were some cases that were filed that really shouldn't have been filed using ADA?
One of the really good cases was a man who was deaf in Alabama. He was sitting in a restaurant with his kids, and his car was blocking somebody. And this guy came up and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Buddy, you need to move your car." And the guy was kind of hostile, not the deaf man, but the other man. And the deaf man looked, and the guy hit him harder because the deaf man didn't say anything. Of course, he didn't know the guy was deaf. And the deaf man jumped up and hit the other guy. So the manager called the police. The police came. The deaf man started to reach in his pocket to get out a card saying, "I'm deaf." And they thought he was going to pull out a gun or something. And they knocked him on the ground and carried him to jail. That's his children sitting in the restroom. And he was in jail for He was in jail for 10 hours before they allowed a sign language interpreter to work with him and explain that, so that he could explain to the police what was going on. They didn't contact his wife or anything. And he sued the city, what the police force was, and won the case. And, you know, you could just see easily that, you know, if he had been a person, they should have provided a sideline interpreter before they took him to jail. And they didn't. And they're required to talk to people who were here and have to figure out a way to communicate with people who were here. That's basically the case. Another case is very interesting. All the way to the Supreme Court, in Toyota, a woman who worked for Toyota in their office, their factory, her job was to polish or work on the top of the car. So she had to hold her arms up in the air all day and do a polish kind of action. And she got carpal tunnel syndrome. And she asked to be moved to another job. You're not a person with disability because you don't have a carpal tunnel. And that seems like discrimination to us on the surface. But remember that the definition of disability is a mental or physical impairment that can't exist, not work, not just work, but make your life activity. And as part of the discovery for the case, it was determined that she could still do everything she did. She could work in the garden, she could work in the grocery shop, she could pick up things, she could work in the house. And so she was not being a person with a disability because she didn't have an impairment in her major life activities. So that was, I wouldn't say that was a frivolous case, but that was a case where the definition of disability was very important. There have been some cases that are kind of scary where people, you know, like we'll say somebody has an electrical business and they work, we'll say, at a Kroger's supermarket for 7 or 8 years, bagging groceries and bringing in the cart, and they got fired. And the family said, "You fired him because he had an intellectual disability." But he was working all the time and, you know, able to work. And so the court actually said in one area that he doesn't have a disability because he can do most things that anybody else can do. And that's kind of scary when we have a very clear diagnosed disability, he's in special ed, he's gotten all kinds of therapy, and for most any common sense thinking person, he would have a disability. But the court said, no, he doesn't. That's kind of a scary area. The same thing would be true of someone who maybe has a seizure disorder, and they, as long as they take the medication and everything is fine, they don't have any seizures. But the court may say this person doesn't have a disease. They can report to me where people with psychiatric problems, they take their antidepressant medication regularly, and nothing changes significantly in their health. They don't have any. Some courts have said, well, this person is not
Yeah, can you explain the difference between what a hidden disability is?
Yeah. A hidden disability is one that people can't recognize or can't see. For example, a seizure disorder, depression, maybe Asperger's syndrome, an intellectual disability, some sort of disability like maybe even multiple sclerosis, because you may, right now you may be in sort of a state where it's not active, but in the midst of time of it, you're able to do most everything. Tomorrow, you could be unable to walk. But today, that's a hidden disability.
I think a lot of people have trouble understanding what a hidden disability is because it's not visible, and they just assume, like when someone's deaf, that they don't understand what the disability is, and they just assume that they're not responding. That's why, in the case that you stated earlier, they ended up putting him in jail and the guy misunderstanding what was going on.
Right. A lot of folks have learning disabilities, and sometimes those are the hardest. Those folks have the most trouble because you seem a perfectly, person will seem perfectly normal, whatever that means. And you know, you live, or you own your own home, you have a car, you have kids, and maybe you're very successful in your company. But you have a major learning disability. Maybe you can't do math. And you ask for an accommodation to be able to use a calculator or to be able to use a computer or something. You don't have a disability. You're just a normal guy. You don't have a disability. Lots of people have learning disabilities that go, you know, they don't even know they have a learning disability. They just always thought they were stupid. And in fact, they're not stupid, but they're very intelligent. They have learning disabilities. The ADA applies to them as well as to anybody who is deaf or blind.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us, and maybe we can do this again because I think some of our listeners got some good information out of this.
Thank you.
All right, bye.